That oh-so-scary gap between the ideal and the real in families.
These stories try to deal with what's it really like to be in a family? What's the relationship between siblings as they go through a life together? And in my last story, what's it like for siblings who reach old age together and who are still in relationship, sort of whether they like it or not, and are even called upon to take care of one another?
That's Linda McCullough Moore. Writer's Voice Associate Producer Drew Adamack interviews McCullough Moore about her short story collection, This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon. And we also look back to our 2010 interview with Marissa Silver about her short story collection, Alone With You. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Writer Linda McCullough Moore used to be a psychotherapist, not an uncommon previous profession for fiction writers. Being a therapist, I know this because I used to be one too, trains one to be compassionate toward the entirety of a character, the dark as well as the light. So perhaps it's not surprising that McCullough Moore writes the following about her work. Quote, I write stories to heal wounds and get revenge and make people laugh and to manage raging tiger feelings. I write to get attention and approval and notice, even if it masquerades as frank outrage. I write in order to be understood, to understand, to get them all to like me well enough to sit beside me on the sofa in the front room and remember, bring it all back, and laugh and cry together at all the parts that should be laughed and cried about. Linda McCullough Moore is the author of numerous stories, the novel The Distance Between, and her latest, the story collection This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon. The collection chronicles the life of her character Margaret McKenzie in a series of linked stories. Associate producer Drew Adamack interviewed Linda McCullough Moore about the collection this spring.
Welcome to Writer's Voice. I'm Drew Adamack. Today I'm talking with Linda McCullough Moore, author of the literary novel The Distance Between, and a short story collection, This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon. Linda has published literally hundreds of poems, essays, short stories in such places as the Massachusetts Review, Glimmer Train, the Southern Review, the Boston Globe, and House Beautiful. Today I am talking to Linda about her short story collection, This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon. Published in 2011, this collection chronicles protagonist Margaret McKenzie's search for understanding, redemption, and forgiveness through multiple divorces, family dysfunction, and death. McCullough Moore uses a light, sometimes humorous touch to meditate on the meaning of God, family, and belonging. Moore lives and writes in Northampton, Massachusetts. Thank you for joining us on Writer's Voice, Linda.
Thank you.
This is your first collection. How did you go about selecting the stories from among all of those that you have published to be included in this collection?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, I think, for any short story writer. All of the stories in this collection have been previously published in periodicals. And when a writer goes to put a collection together, it seems like a pretty tricky business. And what I decided to do with this collection, and I'm working on a second collection at the moment, but with this collection, I decided that I wanted to show the life of one character across a long expanse of time, so that every story in this collection is about one character, Margaret McKenzie. It begins in 1955 with very close reference to the Second World War and goes through the present time. The stories aren't in chronological order. They move back and forth through the years. But it gave me an opportunity to show one woman and the change and the adventures of a single lifetime.
When you wrote this collection over time, did you see this as a single story?
Yeah. My experience of writing stories is you take what comes, when it comes, how it comes, and you get down on your knees and you say thank you. The writing of fiction is not under driver's control to a large extent. And I've literally had the experience of going back to stories after the fact and thinking, gee, did I write that or did I write this particular section? I think that it's very important for a fiction writer to be willing to let go and to write sometimes in what might be very much like a trance state. So as these stories were written, I think they naturally centered. I have many stories which naturally center around one particular character and her life experience and her sensibilities. So that when I came to choose the collection, there were many stories to choose from.
Throughout the collection, I was really struck by the characters seeming to be searching for something in very subtle, even mundane situations. What is it that they're looking for?
Well, I think that part of the reason this book has had, to me, sort of surprising appeal across generations and to both men and women as readers, I think that they're searching for what we are all searching for, namely love right out of the chute. And beyond that, I think they're trying to make some sense of the things that happened to them during their lives. So really some understanding.
So much of what drives these stories is what's left unsaid. It's quite a subtle trick for the writing of it. How have you been able to craft narrative out of things that are not said?
Well, you know, if you think about the way we all go through a day, most of the internal monologue and, dare I say, dialogue that goes on in our heads never gets spoken. But I think that if any of us were stopped at any given moment in a conversation and someone were to say to us, what do you think the other person is thinking? We could probably come up with some good guesses, or at least some guesses. And I think as a writer, that's some of the terrain that we work in. I think we really think about not only what's going on in the surface of our encounters through a day, but almost more importantly, what's the subtext? What are the things that are left unspoken? And often the unspoken things are the really important ones.
We're talking with Linda McCullough Moore about her first short story collection, This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon. Your characters seem to spend a lot of time looking for the right language to express what they're undergoing and what they're experiencing and what they're feeling. What role does the search for the right language play in your stories?
I think that the primary focus of the language search is that what underlies it is our attempt to make connections with one another. And very often, the experiences that we're having are very difficult to translate into language. And I think it's the job of the writer really to struggle with some of those efforts and to really come to some kind of happy end of the search in terms of communicating what's going on inside the characters and how they might use the expression of those inner things to communicate and connect and form bonds with one another.
I'm Drew Adamack, and I'm talking to Linda McCullough Moore about her story collection, This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon. One of the things that really drew me to these stories is this idea of things that we are supposed to be connected to, home, family, religion. There is a sense of melancholy in the places that we return to for comfort and understanding and connection in your stories. How do you create that dissonance that home isn't at all what we expect or hope for? And what is it that these characters find when they go home?
I think that most of us, if we're honest, compare what we have with an ideal family, that one where everything is perfect and everyone gets together on Sunday for dinner once a week because they actually want to and because they find harmony and peace and acceptance at home. I don't know who your friends are, but in my world, people don't find that to be the case. That's not real life. And I think these stories try to deal with what's it really like to be in a family? What's the relationship between siblings as they go through a life together? And in my last story, what's it like for siblings who reach old age together and who are still in relationship, sort of whether they like it or not, and are even called upon to take care of one another? And you mentioned the melancholy, and I think what goes hand in hand with that is really outrageous humor. A lot of people who have written about this book in particular say that they can't read it in public places because they're laughing out loud a little too frequently. And the things that go on in our families are really funny if we can step back an inch and a half and look at them. I have actual notes that my real-life sister has written me, and I included one in my novel, The Distance Between. And whenever I read that particular sequence at a reading, people in the audience will laugh until they cry. Although, my experience of receiving the note was a very sad thing. But I think a writer does well to always juxtapose the sadness with the things that are really, really funny.
Your characters tend to go home seeking comfort and finding exactly the opposite, or they're looking for places in which things make sense, in which to contextualize their experiences, and they don't find that. How did you come to approach the ideals of home and family and friendship in a way that sort of skews popular conception of what home means, of what family means?
Well, it helped that I had my family of origin for raw material. And I also worked for many years as a psychotherapist in private practice. And people are very generous in that context in sharing their stories and in sharing what life has been like in the trenches. And not only the difficult things that have happened, but also the ways that people sort of marvelously triumph and do well and forge bonds even in the face of what seemed like family situations where the first impulse would be to just walk away and maybe never come back. And I think that in these stories, one of the things that sometimes happens is while a particular character doesn't find the solace or the comfort or even the love that he might have been seeking, he does in fact find a kind of relationship that has a wry and in some ways satisfying resonance. And it's something very wonderful about life that we don't always find what we're looking for, but sometimes what we find is really fine.
But in the last story, the sisters seem to reach an understanding with each other, an imperfect understanding, but it goes back to what you just said, which is they reach a point in their lives, at the end of their lives, in which they accept each other. Is that a correct reading of that?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. And I think that these stories have reverberations. Someone came to a reading of this particular story, and he said to me afterward, some weeks later, he said that he had recontacted a sister, somebody he'd been out of contact with for many years, and was able to have a conversation and was very hopeful about the conversation going forward. And I think one of the really nice things about old age is you keep getting more chances. And we keep getting more chances with our siblings. And I remember one of the truisms when I was studying to be a therapist was that much is made of the importance of parents in our lives. But in point of fact, siblings influence us enormously. And a lot of my writing has to do with narratives about the relationships between siblings.
Linda McCullough Moore, there's a really strong thread throughout these stories of potential lost or potential not lived up to. Was this a conscious decision that you made to trace the effects of potential lost or lost potential?
I think that any time a fiction writer sets out to write a story or a novel, we have questions in mind and questions that we'd like to grapple with. And one of the questions that interests me greatly, both in my fiction and also in my nonfiction, is what are the things in life that are most satisfying, and what are the things that really make a difference in our lives? And I think in some of these stories, what the characters discover is that while the concept of religion or the concept of nationalism or family may let them down, in fact, there's an essence in each of these things that's deeply meaningful. So that, say, for instance, in the case of religion, a common misconception about the nature of faith may not be what answers at the end of the day, where in the experience of the characters, what they find is that the essence of belief is deeply meaningful.
I'm Drew Adamack, and you are listening to Writer's Voice. We are talking with writer Linda McCullough Moore about her story collection, This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon. There was a line that really struck me in the story Book Club as part of this collection. A character is described as having been murdered by his memory. What is the relationship with these characters to their memories?
Well, it's interesting you pick on that story. I sent this collection to my lifelong hero, heroine, Alice Munro. And this was the story in the collection that she liked the most and responded to. I think that we have a very multifaceted relationship with memory. We have what actually happened, which I think is quickly forgotten. And almost by definition, when we remember something, we add or subtract or in some way distort the event that we're remembering. In this instance, the man suffers some abuse as a child that he only remembers well into adulthood, and the memory really slays him in that instance. And that's certainly something that has been a common occurrence for a number of people who have suffered significant abuse. But I think all day long we all traffic in memory to some extent, even if it's a rehash of what happened in the last 5 minutes. And I think that as a fiction writer, it's a very rich mine to work in, because as we change and as we grow, sometimes the nature of our memories change in really interesting ways, so that a story we might tell in our 20s might be very different, say, 20 or 30 years later when we recount the same story. And everyone knows the experience of sitting around with your brothers and your sisters when you're adults and recalling things that happened in childhood. And each of you remembers it so very differently. But memory's important. I mean, memory's a big part of who we are.
How has your personal background influenced your writing?
It will come as no surprise to the readers of my books that I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, one of four children, all of whom have been written about in some forgiving or non-forgiving detail through the years. And I trained initially as a psychotherapist and worked in private practice. And then at the age of 40, I was looking for a career change, and I thought, what do I like to do most in the world? And I thought, read. And I thought, how can I be paid for reading? And realized that no one was standing in line to pay me to do that. And that writing was closest to that. And literally, that was the progression of thought one afternoon. And I began writing at the age of 40 and never looked back. So that through the years, I've been working both in fiction and in essay. And also, for about 20 years, have been leading writing workshops of other writers, many of whom are professionals in other fields, people who would like very much to add creative writing. Maybe they do professional writing, but they would really like to try their hand at professional writing. And a number of the people that I have mentored through the years have gone on to complete books and which they have published, and it's really a wonderful way to be with other people, to work on writing together.
Does this collection tell Margaret's story in its entirety, or are there more stories to come out of her life?
No, I think this is just the tip of the iceberg, and as I'm putting this second collection together now, I'm realizing that I could do what seems like an infinite number of collections around this one character. And I write in first-person present tense, which allows me to give voice to a lot of the experience and understanding that seems important to me. But I really do have a number of stories that that explore different facets of this person's experience. And if you take any one of us across the course of a lifetime, we all have some pretty interesting stories to tell.
I'm Drew Adamack, and I'm discussing This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon with author Linda McCullough Moore. Are Margaret's stories the only stories that you get, or are these part of a collection of stories that you receive from your creative well?
Well, I certainly have stories that are very different. I have a number of stories through the years that are written as a man. The main character is a man, and convincingly so, I think, because editors will sometimes respond and ask the sex of the writer. And one thing that I think I do is my stories are fairly close to home. They're fairly close to daily life, to common experience in this country at this time. And I sort of browbeat myself occasionally and say I should branch out and I should be writing about other times and other countries. And I think as writers, and I certainly study writers a lot, I think we each have one thing that's our particular thing. And I think these are my stories. These are what I have to share. They're meaningful to me. The feedback that I get indicates that they're meaningful to readers. And so for better or worse, that's my story, and I'm going to stick to it.
But in the end of this collection, she finds something. Is it forgiveness or is it understanding that she finds in the end of this, in this last story?
I think that what happens in the last story between the two sisters who are now getting on in years is that at the end of the day, they are both entirely honest with each other. And when they come to each other without any artifice and without any masquerade, and they really are open to one another and share who they actually are, that there's a lot more room for acceptance than there had been when they were each sort of perhaps trying to impress one another or trying to behave in a certain way for appearance. So I think there's something very genuine and very honest about the resolution that they reach, and I think it's why it is sort of heartbreaking in the end, because it always raises the question, couldn't we have gotten there better sooner? Have we wasted all this time when we might have been friends?
It's that realization that I get now that I'm even getting a little older is, whoa, I could have gotten here with so much less hassle, so yes. much less struggle.
Well, I think one of the things that's remarkable to me about this particular collection, to the extent that it's deeply interior, that it's a woman's story from a woman's point of view, and so much in that direction, that the response I've had from men who have read the book is both so positive, but also they seem to relate to it so closely. And I'm very pleased with that response, because I think that if a fiction writer can do something that makes the human experience a little more understandable or a little more comprehensible at all, you know, we've done something. And certainly I think that a big part of why we read is to check it out and see what other people are experiencing, and where do we fit in the world, and what are our relationships actually like, and what are they made of, and what are we made of? So I'm very pleased with the response to this book, that it has something to say to everybody. And I've also been surprised at the response of young readers, very young readers, who resonate with a lot of the elements of the book.
As a male reader, that's the thing that struck me, in part because I come from a small Rust Belt city in the Midwest, or town rather, in which all of the things of our childhood that seemed to be promised to us, you know, economic stability and social stability and cultural stability, has all sort of disappeared in the last 25 to 30 years. And the life that I thought I was going to have economically and professionally as a child is gone, which is why this idea of their lost potential or the failure of expectations struck me so strongly in the collection, because that's an idea that resonates with me personally.
Yeah, and I think if the present economic climate does anything to us as individuals, I think it sort of throws us back on other resources. I think that when certain things are stripped away and we can't count on those externals, which we imagined that we could, however illusory that might have been, but when those things are not on offer, I think we really begin to think about bigger questions. And I think then there's room for the question of faith, and room for the question of relationships, and what does give meaning to a life.
We've been talking to Linda McCullough Moore about her story collection, This Road Will Take Us Closer to the Moon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Drew Adamack, and this is Writer's Voice.
Next up, we listen to my 2010 interview with Marissa Silver about her short story collection, Alone With You. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Don't go away.
Starts with an earthquake, or the tears of a few grieving women. I don't know. They're on the road together. Looking for someone to roll away the stone. Stands alone in her room as the commotion slowly decays.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, we're talking with writers of short stories, and among my favorite collections of such stories is that by writer Marissa Silver, Alone With You. I spoke with her about it in 2010. Called one of California's most celebrated contemporary writers by the New York Times, Marissa Silver writes both long and short fiction. We first spoke to her in 2008 about her wonderful novel, God of War. Now she's come out with an equally wonderful collection of stories, Alone with You. One theme they explore is the ambiguities in human relationships, the push and pull we feel towards those we love. Another is the responsibilities we have toward each other. I sat down with Marissa Silver at her publisher, Simon & Schuster, in New York recently to talk about the craft of writing and her latest collection of stories. Marissa Silver, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
The last time I spoke with you, it was about a novel. This Alone With You is a collection of wonderful stories. I really just want to kind of dive into different ones of them, if you don't mind. Let's just start out with Temporary. All of them, I think, had surprises in them. And I think that was some of the, aside from the language, which is also really beautiful, it's the surprise in every story that really got me. And here in Temporary, tell us a little bit about the main character of this story.
Temporary is a story about a young woman in her early 20s named Vivian, and she's just recently moved to Los Angeles from Oklahoma. Her mother has died recently, and she's sort of just starting out life, and she finds a temporary situation living with another girl named Shelley in a sort of a loft downtown that shouldn't be lived in, and it's really an industrial space. And she's sort of beginning to make her way in her life. She gets a job at an adoption agency, which has a resonance in her own life because she, too, is adopted. And the story is really, you know, really about just that temporality of life, that, you know, her growing recognition of how fleeting things are, how hard it is to locate yourself in your life. It's a lot about being that age, you know, that time in your 20s where you sort of walk through any door that's open and you're not quite sure why, and then suddenly you find yourself someplace or with some people and you're not even sure why. That it's not so much about being choiceful as it is about just sort of taking whatever road seems to appear. And that's how you begin to define who you are. She's sort of an undefined character. She's sort of someone who's grappling for who she is. And so the story really is about that moment in life.
Yet she does need to make a choice in this, a choice of what to believe about her own parents' marriage. So there's another plot going on here. Her mother is ill. Her father is a loving father. And yet there's a question.
Yeah, she sees him in a moment with another woman, and she can't quite understand what that moment means. She's not sure how to interpret it. She has to make a decision about what to believe. And a lot of what the story is about is sort of how you have to make decisions, what you're going to believe. And they could be wrong or they could be right. It ultimately doesn't matter. It's more about the decision that you make. And I think that we all do that in life as we go along about, you know, who to trust, about loyalty, about, you know, intimacy. And, you know, you make these choices, and there's never a lot of evidence, and yet you make choices. So that's something that she experiences.
It doesn't matter what choice you make?
Well, I think it matters what choice you make, but I don't know that you know what the right choice is, really. I mean, a choice may appear right to you. Is it right? I don't know. I mean, we all have moral judgments, and we all can say, oh, well, he shouldn't have left his wife, or you know, but... You know, how do we know? We don't really know. And what life is about the sum of those choices. So I guess when I write, I tend to be less judgmental of my characters and more sort of open to understanding choice and what the ramifications of choices are. I'm not so much interested in moralizing or kind of trying to depict a world that's black and white. I'm much more interested in the ambiguity and the grays.
Yeah, in fact, I wrote down as I was thinking of this interview, I wrote down ambiguities. That is the place that you inhabit in these stories, and I think that that's why they do have the surprises that they do, because one doesn't really know what a character is going to do. In Leap, that's another story in which there's some kind of ambiguity. There's a dog who is seen as attempting suicide.
Leap is a sort of a slightly more humorous story, but actually at its heart, it's not. It's about a woman who sort of understanding the connection between danger and love, and how love can be dangerous. She has a dog who she's devoted to, and at one point in the story, the dog sort of takes this unreasonable leap off a cliff. It doesn't seem to be in response to anything like a scurrying squirrel or food. She decides to interpret it as the dog choosing to commit suicide. The dog doesn't die. But I think the fact that she interprets it that way is what's important. It's not whether or not the dog did. And, you know, I don't know whether animals choose to kill themselves. I have no idea. I think it's probably a human construct. And so it's probably hard to, you know, lay that on an animal. But the fact that she thinks that has a lot to do with what she's struggling with in the story, to try to understand, you know, when life is difficult, what makes you hold on.
Yeah, and there's a point in the story in which she feels, well, maybe love is too dangerous. Her marriage is not going well. But then at the end of the story, she's happy that there was so much trouble yet to come. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that what she understands in the story is that part of what makes life rich and surprising is the fact that there's trouble. I mean, you know, that there are complications, that it's not obvious, that it's not easy, that you're sorting through things that are troubling and difficult. And I think that she sort of, you know, she's in a place where she's got to choose whether to remain with a guy who is sort of stepping out on her or not. And I think that she doesn't and recognizes that, you know, that's part of where her emotional juice is going to come from is the troubles.
It's interesting. We were just talking before we started about some issues facing people of our generation with our parents. I'm facing that. And I was just saying to you that, you know, with all the trouble, it's been an enriching experience. It's made me become a better person.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, not always. Sometimes trouble makes you do things that aren't you're not showing off your best side, but that's life. You know, we are confronted with things and we behave, and sometimes we behave in ways that, you know, sort of amplify the goodness of us, and sometimes we behave in ways that reveal the pettiness of us, and that's what's interesting. I mean, to me, that's what's interesting about character. That's what draws me to write, is because I always think of those Advent calendars at Christmas where you open a door. I mean, everybody's a little door that can be opened, and then you see inside, and you see how they behave, and you see how they react to certain situations, and then how they react to the consequences of those certain situations, and it's like a endless mystery story, human behavior.
It almost sounds, the way you're talking, as if it's like Zen, like to be a writer is to be able to observe and to observe with compassion one's own characters. That is to be a fiction writer.
Yeah, although I don't think there's anybody in my life who would describe me as Zen, but I'll take that. I think that for me, yeah, I mean, writing is two things. It's about observing. It's also about shaping. I mean, there's a craft in writing. And so, you know, I am exerting a kind of architecture and a shape on the work that I make. I'm bringing craft to it. So there's definitely it's sort of a combination of those two things. It's both being the observational eye and then shaping that into a narrative that someone would want to read. I mean, we don't always want to hear, you know, the real stories of our lives are not always fascinating or interesting. The real dialogue that we say to one another is not always fascinating or interesting. So part, I think, of what the writer, I think, gets to do is to find the shape of the story and bring their craft to the story so that life is a little bit heightened and we recognize our lives, but we're being shown something that maybe is a little bit sort of floating a little bit above the normal life that we all live.
But doesn't compassion also come into it? And that's certainly the sense that I get from reading these stories in Alone With You, Marissa Silver. I get the sense that there's a real, in being able to explore the ambiguities, you can only do that from a point of compassion for your characters.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that, as I said earlier, you know, to be judgmental, I think, is to not only lose your characters in all their colors, but also to lose a reader because, you know, a reader doesn't want to be told what to think of somebody. They want to decide what they want to think of that character themselves. And the only way that I can write characters in a way that feels where they become palpable and rich to me is to sort of suspend is to be compassionate for their foibles. I mean, not everyone in this book does, you know, a good or right thing in sort of an a subjective way. I mean, in an objective way. So, I have tremendous compassion. I don't even sort of even think about it in a funny way. You know, when I'm inhabiting characters, I just think about what are they going to do? I feel for them, but mostly I'm just concerned with what they're doing. I'm not even really thinking about, am I compassionate or not? I'm just saying this feels the thing that they would do.
How does that happen?
It happens in a really slow way. It happens a lot in the way that real relationships happen in life, I think. You know, when you meet somebody, you know very little about them. You have certain cues, what they look like, maybe what they said about something, and you begin to, little by little, knowing them more and more, begin to sort of deepen your understanding of who they are. And, you know, they may behave a certain way in a situation. You think, oh, they're a little different than I thought. You know, your understanding them becomes more nuanced. And with character, it's really the same thing. I mean, I start off with a shred of, I mean, almost nothing, you know, a woman, a girl, somebody with long hair, you know, there might be that much. And then I sort of throw action in their way, and I try to see how they'll behave in the face of those actions, and that helps me understand them more. And you know, it's I don't know who they are at the beginning. I'm learning in the same way that a reader is going to be learning as he or she reads the story. So it's a long process of digging deeper and deeper and deeper, and trying to find out what the difference is between who they say they are and what they really are, and what their actions reveal about themselves that might be different from what they thought. I think everybody carries around a certain mythology about themselves, which is often at odds with the way other people perceive them. And then it's a lot about how they are perceived by others. I mean, you know, we are only perceptions of other people. You know, I mean, we may have our own idea of ourselves, but we are known through other people as well. So, you know, it's always thinking about, well, how does another person see that person? So a character exists on so many different levels, and it's just a long, sort of slow, patient process to get deeper and deeper.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with fiction writer Marissa Silver about her latest collection of stories, Alone With You. I wonder if you could tell us about that process with one of my favorite stories in this book, although that was hard to choose because there were many that I loved. But that one is Pond.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. I love that story. Pond is a story that's told in three sections, and it is a story about, it begins as a story about a family, a mother and a father and a 24-year-old daughter who's developmentally delayed. So she probably behaves much like a 4-year-old. And she's pregnant. And in the first part of the story, you see the family sort of, dealing with this imminent birth of a child. And then the second part of the story takes place a few years later when the mother and the daughter and the baby are at a duck pond. And the third part of the story takes place about 7 years later when the father and the daughter and the now 9-year-old boy are by a river. And it's a story that was really, I mean, I never know what my stories are about when I write them. And I oftentimes don't know what they're about for a long time after I write them. This is one I really didn't know what it was about. And I kept changing points of view because I kept thinking there's more here. And I need to go, see it from a different angle and see it from a different angle. And so by the end of the story, even I was surprised at what the story became about, which was sort of, it ends up being really the father's story, which is the character who you know the least in the beginning of the story. So it was a really exhilarating story to write. You know, it was a story where I was dealing both with the emotion and also with the form of writing, which was really fun.
How did you alight on the character of Martha?
You know, I don't know. I never know how to answer that question. Characters kind of appear. And I mean, I hate to say that because it sounds so, gooey or, I'm too hard bitten for that kind of thing. But characters do appear. And I mean, they appear, I suppose, as a result of a lot of subconscious thought, a lot of rumination, but not pointedly so. You know, I never start a story by saying, oh, I'm going to write about a girl and her father. And I don't. I sort of suddenly this character appeared and I had the first line of the story. And then I just started going with that. I suddenly had a situation. Here's a woman who's developmentally delayed and is pregnant. What now? Mm-hmm. sometimes stories start with an image. Sometimes stories start with a line of dialogue. It's really random. And I think that there's, but for me, I guess what draws me into a story is that whatever that inciting moment is for me reaches very deeply into me in a way that I think, oh, there's so much more here to mine. There's something that really connects to me. It's sinking its claws into me. I don't know what it is. So my job is to sort of, you know, wrestle with it until I find out why that resonates with me. Because there's plenty of ideas that I have that, you know, seem superficially interesting, and they don't go deep. Then I can't get to the next place with them. They don't really sink their claws into me. They don't have the emotional resonance for me that I need to spend time with something.
In this character, in the relationship between this character, Martha, who's developmentally delayed, and her son, I felt a kind of echo of your first, the book that I spoke to you about last time, The God of War. There also, there's a character who's taking care of his mentally, I guess, autistic mm-hmm. brother.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think the issues of responsibility, the responsibilities that we have towards one another is something that I still think about and write about. It interests me, you know, the family structure interests me. I think because it's this kind of potent, constantly changing structure. People are growing, people are splitting up, coming together. There's never a stasis in a family structure. And so one of the things that really interests me about family is how we draw the lines between ourselves and our responsibility to the other people who are close to us. And I think it's an always changing line. I don't think that it's ever stable. In another story in the collection called Night Train to Frankfurt, it's about a woman who's taking her mother to this esoteric clinic in Frankfurt, Germany, as a last ditch effort to cure her mother of a really, you know, a virulent cancer. And so it's sort of a fool's journey from the start. I don't think, you know, I'm not sure anybody in the story believes what it's going to do any good, but they're doing it. There's sort of this hope. And it's a lot about this woman who's in her, I guess she's in her early 30s, sort of trying to figure out where she stands vis-a-vis her mother, where her responsibility to her mother is, where her responsibility to following her mother's kind of offbeat strategies for dealing with her cancer lie. And I guess that those really interest me. I think that, I mean, the collection as a whole, I mean, the title Alone With You is sort of, you know, the stories all circle around this idea of, you know, how are we together and alone at the same time? And how does intimacy and separation, how do they coexist? Because I think they do. And I don't think that you're always intimate with somebody. I think you have these transcendent moments of intimacy. But there's always this sense of the aloneness of the individual, which is sort of intractable. And so all these stories wrestle in some way with this idea of, you know, when are we close and when are we not? You know, how are we, if we're all these, you know, planets that are orbiting each other, when do we draw close and when do we pull away?
And there's a point in that story, Night Train to Frankfurt, where that character, the daughter, enters that kind of a certain moment of grace where it's enough just to simply be. Mm-hmm. And she accepts that things are not in life the way you expect them to be.
Yeah, she has another storyline in that story. The daughter, one of her jobs is she's a page turner for the Philharmonic. And so she recounts a story of being present when the pianist sort of fumbles and stumbles. And the moment where she doesn't know what her responsibility is in that moment and what it is best for her to do. You know, you don't stand up and point to the page in the middle of the Philharmonic. On the other hand, she feels that she's somehow suddenly tied in this incredible drama with this woman. And it's very much the same thing that exists for her with her mother. You know, how does she can't, I think what she realizes is that she can't help her mother live, but she can be present exactly as she gets through the rest of her life.
Then the title story, Alone With You, there the perspective shifts. You have a woman who has been diagnosed or suffering with some kind of mental illness. Her family is, you know, feeling an exaggerated kind of sense of responsibility toward her. Not exaggerated in the sense that it's wrong, but in the sense that they're not altogether comfortable about you know, what they have to do. Mm-hmm. for her. And she takes them on a journey into the desert in which she's looking for some kind of freedom.
Yeah. In that story, the woman sort of suffers, you know, she's from a very deep kind of anxiety and depression. And I think that, I mean, the twist in that story is as you said, that it's the, you know, the family who feels that they're taking care of her, and in a way, what happens by the end of the story is that she's made a choice of how to take care of them, which may be something very different from what they felt should be done. But for her, it's the only choice to make.
In fact, I wondered if you'd be willing to read a little piece from that story, which I just thought was wonderful. In fact, it's the very end. Set us up first, but I'd like you to start right here.
And go to the end? They're in the desert in Morocco. And along this journey, the son's girlfriend has gotten ill, and the mother has stayed with the girlfriend while the others went ahead. And now they're all they've all convened at the camp, and it's nighttime. The father is Edward, I should say, and Teddy is the son, and Elise is the son's girlfriend, and Maria is the main character. Edward stood back, his expression contorting slightly as he watched the young couple discover the sky. Marie remembered when Edward had shown Teddy how to cast a rod, his pride in his own mentoring replaced by the recognition of loss, as Teddy easily grasped the technique. Marie understood that for her husband, knowledge was his defense against emptiness. How hard it had been for him this year to have understood so little of what she was experiencing. She had betrayed him. She hadn't meant to, but that's what had happened. Marie chose not to sleep that night. When she'd begun to take the dulling medications, she'd taught herself how to defy sleep. The skill had felt like some measure of victory over her situation. She had loved the nighttime hours, especially when she was not assaulted by the raucous sounds of the day, the car doors opening and slamming shut, the Doppler of the neighborhood children's voices as they walked to and from school. Unmistakable rustlings came from Teddy and Elise's tent, and then stifled moans. Edward, turning in his sleeping bag, and opened his eyes for a moment. His face was soft, his expression confused. "Shh," she whispered, until his eyelids lowered and his breathing became light again. Carefully, she took his hand in hers. She felt its weight, the warmth of it, despite the cold air. She thought of him foolishly chasing after the girl. And why not? Weren't they all turning toward the sun, yearning for life? It was only that they had discovered that they needed to look away from one another to find their futures. She had come to the desert in order to make a decision. She had once been unable to imagine living, but now she could only imagine it. Life was a needy child that you wished both to hold and escape from. She could envision herself inside the tumult, the confusion, the utter illogic of it. She believed she could endure the terror, but she could only manage it alone. But she could not pretend to be other than who she was. She thought about how it would happen. Would she pack her things and drive away while Edward was at work? Or would she stay and confront him with her choice when he returned at the end of the day? A conversation might be difficult for him. It would demand words he did not have, feelings he could not name. She did not want to be unkind. She closed her eyes and saw the stars against the infinite night of her eyelids. She imagined their migration to some other part of the world. Soon, in a place far away, other people would look up and point and wonder and realize that they were only strangers visiting a foreign land.
The foreign land.
You know, it's the world we're in. It's a strange, kind of magical, hard place. And I think that none of us knows what we're in for. And that's both frightening and exciting. I think we don't know the rules. We don't know the customs when we get here, much the way you don't when you're traveling. And we're visitors for a pretty short time. So that's what that line means.
And yet we can see the stars.
We can see the stars. It's incredible. I have been to the desert in Morocco, and I've never seen that. I've never seen a firmament. I understood what the word firmament meant for the first time. It was astonishing. You really felt the vastness of the universe, and you could see the curve of the earth. You could see how the stars were passing across the sky. It was kind of a really exhilarating moment for me.
Marissa Silver, your stunning collection of stories is Alone With You. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marissa Silver. I spoke with her in 2010 about her collection of stories, Alone With You. You can read an excerpt from the story Temporary at writersvoice.net. And you can also hear our 2008 interview with Silver about her novel, God of War. Well, we've got some time left on the show today, and as is our custom when that happens, we bring you poetry, either from our archives or from audio recordings available commercially. Here's Jack Kerouac reading Canto Uno from McDougal Street Blues. It's from the 3-CD set, Poetry Speaks Expanded, out from Sourcebooks Press.
The goofy, foolish human parade, passing on Sunday art streets of Greenwich Village. Pitiful drawings of images on an iron fence, ranged there by self-believing artists with no hair and black berets, showing green seas eating at rock and Pleiades of time, pestiferating at moon squid, salt flat, tip fly toe, tat sand traps, with cigar-smoking interestives puffing at the stroll. I mean sincerely, naive sailors buying prints. Women with red banjos on their handbags, and arts handicrafty, slow-shuffling ardors of Washington Square, passing in what they think is a happy June afternoon. Good God, the sorrow! They don't even listen to me when I try to tell them they will die. They say, of course I know I'll die. Why should you mention it now? Why should I worry about it? It'll happen now. I want a good time. Excuse me, it's a beautiful, happy June afternoon. I want to walk in. Why are you so tragic and gloomy? And on the corner at the pony stables on 6th Avenue and 4th sits Bodhisattva meditating in hobo rags, praying at Joe Gould's chair for the emancipation of the shufflers passing by. Immovable in meditation, he offers his hand and feet to the passers-by, and nobody believes that there's nothing to believe in. Listen to me. There is no sidewalk art show. No strollers are there. No poem here. No June afternoon of O, but only imagelessness, unrepresented on the iron fence of bald artists with black berets passing by. One moment less than this is future nothingness already. The chessmen are silent, assembling ready for funny war. Voices of Washington Square blues rise to my Bodhisattva poem window. I will describe them. Itki salusu fruptrut, etc. No need. No words to describe the sound of ignorance. This is the sound of ignorance. They are strolling to their death, watching the pictures of hell, eating ice cream of ignorance on wood sticks that were once sincere in trees. But I can't write poetry, just prose. I mean, this is prose, not poetry. But I want to be sincere.
I don't know. Sounds like poetry to me. That was Jack Kerouac reading Canto Uno from McDonald Street Blues. It's on the 3-CD set Poetry Speaks Expanded, out from Sourcebooks Press. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.